This is an introduction to a lot of the points. Ellie mentioned a lot of them. Explained it very well. Just tried to give a bigger picture of a lot of the points. The first thing I said last year on that trip was that as Americans, as contemporary people, we're used to countries. And countries are fixed. Canada has been Canada the way we remember it. America's been America, and Mexico's Mexico. And if Russia had the audacity to take to bite off Crimea from Ukraine, we're very upset about the idea. That's not history. History was areas that were defined, fairly well defined, and all types of countries that sort of swallowed other countries, joined up with other countries, split apart, and that's why provinces tend to be a lot more historically significant than countries. Take a look at the map. Now, this is the center of Europe. And on your left side, you would have France and Germany and Switzerland, Italy. And that sort of defines West Europe. Then you have this whole chunk in the middle of Austria, Czech, Slovakia, Hungary, Balkan countries, Romania, and Ukraine to some degree. And that defines sort of the center of it. That's what we're talking about. Now, who are the big players? The big players last year we spoke about was Russia. Russia always loves to swallow countries and embrace them. So Litauen, Belarus, and all of that was being either swallowed or in the process or whatever it is. That was one. The big player, there were two big players. If you take a look at the map, Austria is on the left of the map. And that was a big player. And at the bottom of the map, you have the Ottoman Empire, which was Turkey, which for Kufa was a big player. And then you have, on the right, you have all sorts of hordes coming in from Mongolia and other places, which at some point had some impact. So basically, Hungary was a fairly defined area with fairly defined tribes, but a small piece. And the country kept growing and getting smaller depending time to time. Some of the major events were the conquest by the Ottomans in the middle of the 16th century all the way to almost the 18th century. That was the that was 150 years of Ottoman conquest. What the Ottoman conquest did for the Jewish people was it had Jews migrating down into the Balkans. And that's where you get a lot of Jewish settlements in the Balkans. You also had some Jews immigrating up. But that was one big player. At some point, they were defeated. And then Austria, in different kufas, had different relationships. Sometimes it was outright owned by Austria. Sometimes Austrians were held at bay, and at some point in the mid-1800s, late 1800s, and they agreed to a joint empire, which is kind of a strange arrangement of Austria-Hungary Empire. It's two separate countries, two separate parliaments, but one king that everybody owes up to. That is the picture of Hungary and the countries around it. Now, for Jews, so we spoke about during the Roman Empire, Jews wandered up north. Wherever the Romans went, Jews went because that's where business was, that's where opportunity was, and Jews wandered. That's the style of Jews. So Jews wandered up through Italy, France, Germany. That was a big Balitosvis and so on. That was one chunk. And then there were Jews that wandered through the Balkans, and handfuls of Jews would wander up to Hungary. In the earlier period, a big influence was when things became rough in France and Germany, and Jews looked to move out. Hungary, Yizachar Latov, there was a king, Kalman, who did not allow the Crusaders to hurt the Jews. He might have had selfish interests, but better for selfish interests not to be hurt than to be hurt for L'shem Shemayim. You know, I traded his Shalom L'shma for the Pope's L'shma. And the Jews in general, either conditions became rough or you look for opportunities and you keep wandering. So in what was Hungary for a long time, there were three types of Jews that wandered in, and it's very important to understand the difference. There was Germanic Austrian Jews, and they tended to be in Slovakia, which was part of Hungary for a very long time. And that was one influx. Galiciana Jews came in from Poland. That was another filtering down. You had Jews that migrated into central Hungary, like Budapest, like with a physical center of Hungary. And you had Jews that came in from the north, from the northeast, from Ukraine, Carpathian Jews, Russian Jews, and so on. So we're talking about nothing before the mid 1700s. There was nothing doing. I mean, the census in the mid 1700s was officially 14,000 Jews. So we'll assume there were 30,000 Jews. But at the end of the day, that's the numbers you're talking about. 100 years later, you already had numbers. There were like 100,000. So there was once they freed themselves from the Ottoman Empire. Once things settled down, Jews began just looking for opportunities. It created three different Jewries. There was Slovakian Jewry, which became Chasam Sofer, which they called Oberlander, it means the upper lands. They were a very interesting group of people. They were Germanic in temperament, very Germanic. The language was a German Yiddish. They were strong Kehillahs, lived together, and so on. They were quite, as Hungary goes, they were, I don't know what the word is, sophisticated. They were more city people, more kind of, you know, they had that stamp of proper, put together, with it a little bit more, and so on. That was one group. There were the group that ended up in the middle of Hungary, like Budapest and so on. They tended to be more rural. Even though Budapest is a city, they tended to become very quickly, and like Ellie mentioned, they became very Hungarian. They were interested in being Hungarian. They liked the good life, and they were kind of never very powerfully attracted. They were very Hungarian. And then you had the Russian Jews that came out of Ukraine. They tended to be village people, unlettered, you know, very, very kind of simple folk, and they became Hasidim. And when Hasidus, and we'll talk about tomorrow, when Hasidus came, that's the place where they found themselves. We look at the outside, Hasidim and the Slovakian Jews were not similar at all. The Slovakian Jews have disappeared more or less. They have been absorbed by Hasidim, but they were very different cultures. As an example, Rev Weissmandel was a Slovakian. He was an Oberlander. If you see pictures of him before the war, he wore a short jacket. He wore a tie. He wore gold-rimmed glasses, which was kind of shtadi. And he had a very put-together look in his face. Yes, Peter, you're shtadi. The Hasidim were kind of very, very, I don't want to use the word peasant-like, but the Hasidus was a very folksy, homesy, warm Hasidus, and so on and so forth. There was three groups of Jews that lived there, and they each had their own destiny. They really were very distinct people. They didn't belong in one country. They really weren't in one country. Slovakia was a very clearly defined area. Central Hungary was a defined area, and the Ukrainian part of it.
Well, the borders opened up that a person who felt more like, you know, in alignment with Hasidus, for example, would he actually travel, go out of his way to be there, or just that's just what was
it's
there?
It's the other way around. In other words, the type of people that Ukraine was sort of the cradle of where Hasidus came from, so they sort of flow down. Those type of people, they would more naturally wanted a warm, caring leader. Now, in terms of the level of general sophistication, Europe had, Berlin was in a certain sense the intellectual capital of Europe. Vienna was one step more into the arts and music and so on. It still was somewhat of an intellectual capital, but the people were a lot more into gracious life, so to speak. And Budapest was another Madriga down or up, depending on whether you like food or you like books. It was more food, less books. That was kind of the, you know, and Baruch Hashem, I'm happy by supper to be sitting in a place where they like good food and you know, they leave the books for us. But that also affected very strongly the type of Jews and what would happen and so on. So until the 1700s, nothing that of modern era really existed there. And that's when Jews started coming. It had a lot to do with a lot of things that were going on in Hungary and out of Hungary.
Where were they coming from?
No one's coming from Eretz. There's nobody here in Eretz. There's nobody here in the 1700s. They were coming from Galicia. They were coming from Galicia and Poland, one place. Okay. They were coming from Ukraine, Russia, another place. And they were filtering in the center of Hungary. There was either filtration of people just moving. You have to remember also Jews were always restricted in terms of what trades they could ply. So because they were so restricted, no community could support more than one, there's X amount of moneylenders you can support, X amount of this. Jews were not usually farmers. And most countries, they couldn't be farmers. So you had basically a natural need to keep pushing. So you had people coming in. Now, and people, generally speaking, most of the communities in Hungary were not terribly knowledgeable. This goes through the generations. Because it was kind of at the far end of where people were coming to, most people really were not terribly knowledgeable. There's somebody in the 1400s of Isaac Turno writes about how he wrote a sefer of Minhagim because Hungarian people are not terribly knowledgeable, they don't know enough. And generally, it did not have a reputation for scholarship, which meant that at some point it was easy for people to step in and to start making trouble. Now. Some very important events, and this is, again, Ellie mentioned this, and I think it's very important. Austria woke up one morning and found, after they divided Poland for the first time, Austria had an incredible amount of Jews, a lot more than they bargained for. And there were two shitas about how to deal with it. One was try to get rid of them. There were different times when they tried that. You know, they had... And one of the things that pushed migration was there was a time when, you know, they had all sorts of hardships, expelled Jews, Xeris and Jews, all sorts of things. But then they decided that the 1800s that the smartest thing to be would be to integrate them. And the king, the first king, Joseph, tried to do that. And remember, Austria, Vienna was ruling the country, and they decided that, you know what, if we integrate the Jews, we will not have a Jewish problem. It meant the important parts were schooling. Schooling was that Jews have to go to schools that are run by, based on a curriculum set by the government. That was probably the strongest. That probably would have destroyed everything instantly. Schools was a real issue. Going to the army, conscription to the army was terrible, because living the army life, there was no tolerance for Jewish things, and you lived like a guy for a while, and that was the end of it. There were strong laws about speaking Hungarian. When the Hungarians had an upper hand, they would make laws like that. Those were the outside issues that sort of struck the Jews in different kufis in those years. So we now have three parts of the country, and each one is under tremendous amount of pressure. It started from the mid-1700s, because that's when they first started, getting their act together. It went through the mid-1800s, till the end of the 1800s. Now, let me add one more piece to the puzzle. The 1700s were the years of intellectual upheaval. And you had really the age of revolution, political revolution. People began thinking that government should be secular, government should not be involved in religious stuff, free thinking. The 1700s was an era of tremendous philosophical turmoil and ideological turmoil, and the storm that would come in the 1800s was brewed in the 1700s. So Mendelssohn, Haskalah, Enlightenment, etc., was there in the 1700s, and people were beginning to read, people were beginning to hope that they could become something else, and it was waiting to explode. It started in Germany as an intellectual revolution, it came to Austria as a social revolution in Yiddishkeit, and it ended up in Budapest on the tailcoats of that. So maybe we'll speak more, so it's late today and people are tired, but this is going to be the real issue of how do you deal with it? How do you deal with this wave, that is coming in? Mostly, they wanted to make life comfortable and convenient. You have to understand something. Hungarian Jews, most of them knew nothing. And if the rabbi says that you can do X, then who am I to disagree? If the rabbi says you're allowed to do Y, well, and especially if I have a choice where a rabbi says you can't do things and a rabbi says you can do things, we'll choose. Communities began choosing rabbanim that they enjoyed the psakim they gave. They were clueless about the mechanics of the psak. Most people were unlettered. People became wealthy, powerful, and they had rabbanim do what they wanted to. And slowly, they had rabbis, rabbanim, and like he mentioned, if you look at a picture of the early rabbanim, the so-called reform rabbis were quote-unquote undistinguishable from regular rabbis. They had beards, they had coats, they had this, they had that. But they were, one of them, Lieberman, Schmat. You know, he used to give psakim for money. Like, every psak had money, and if you wanted a psak, you paid for it, and you got the right psak. And he's Schmat. There were two infamous ones, Chorin and Lieberman. But it rested on the fact that most people were unlettered, unknowledgeable, and, you know, if I have a choice between a rabbi who makes life miserable and a rabbi who makes life pleasant, we take that. That was one factor. And the second factor was the more cosmopolitan Hungarians. In Hungary, Hungarian Jews had a real chance of being Hungarian. It wasn't like Berlin where they're competing with really smart people and really sophisticated people. It wasn't even like Vienna. It was, at the end of the day, it was a backwards, peasantry. And the Jews shone. And now they could become, all they need to do is just become like them. And that was basically the government, until the 1700s, most governments thought the smartest thing to do with religious groups is let them run their own lives. You Jews, run your life, pay us tax, and don't get into trouble. Now they said, no, we need to run their affairs. Disbanded the Batidinim, got rid of rabbinic power, and began dictating, we want you, before we give you full emancipation, let's see something from you. How about making your religion a little more normal? Like, why can't it look like the honey instead of the shtiebel, instead of a little spinker shtiebel? Like, let it look like the honey shul. That's a real thing. You do that, and you'll become as Hungarian as us. It's, unfortunately, it didn't work. But tachlis, this was the mix that was getting set up. How each group dealt with it very separately. And again, we'll see tomorrow, Mitzvah Shem, we'll spend a long day, how Slovakians dealt with it, and Chassam Sofer, how the Hungarians of Budapest dealt with it, and how the Chassidim dealt with it, really were three different ways. You can make arguments who was successful, who wasn't. Obviously, the neologian was very successful. They integrated, they assimilated, and that was the end of it. So if that's your goal, then success was quite marked. But in terms of preserving Yiddishkeit, there were some points, though. It's not as black and white as it seems. And again, like Ellie mentioned appropriately, neologians were different than the German reform. German reform was an intellectual movement. They wanted Bedafka to attack laws and to and so on. It was coming from their understanding what Yiddishkeit is. The Austrians wanted a more batamtish shul, and the Gerius wanted a better Kiddush. Like, that was basically the I'm putting it in a nutshell, that was basically, you're not Hungarian, are you? I'm not assaulting the...
What's wrong with a good Kiddush?
What's wrong with a good Kiddush? and we'll see how, and I guess the lesson for us will be to learn is how each group dealt with it, because every time you have a problem comes up, you know, internet. So one group says the way to deal with it is to ban it. The second group says the way to deal with it is to brace it. The third group says more status quo. Little yes, little not. But it's a lot more nuanced, and we'll see Mitzvah Hashem. We'll speak about some sof, we'll speak about Chassidim, how each group. But basically, the history we're talking about starts in the mid-1700s. Until that time, there weren't enough people living in Hungary. It comes on the backdrop that Hungary is three countries. The old Hungary was three countries. And you have to speak about each group separate, that they're just not the same people. They didn't have the same dynamics. There wasn't much connection between them. And there was technical connections. You have to understand the forces in the government that changed. You notice the pressure from the outside that was happening at that time. And you have to understand the different mindset of these people and what was driving the pros and the cons. So Mr. tomorrow we'll continue on this and we'll speak more specifically about it, as we have different groups. Sure. Yeah.